Well, hello again and welcome to another edition of Authors Audio. I'm your host, Jake D. Steele. Remember, you can listen to all our interviews by visiting our website at www.authorsaudio.com and click on the listen icon or the iTunes icon and download all the programs that way. I have with me today a very interesting gentleman. His name is James Andrew Barrett. He is a student of religious and mystical traditions. He embarked in 1995 on an odyssey to create a real-time cardiobiofeedback device. The resulting data from their innovative approach demonstrated the inherent heart-based intelligence was driving many of the psychological and physical systems important to our wellness. In March of 2000, a life-altering epiphany occurred when his son of 27 years of age died unexpectedly without a known cause. During those tremendous weeks of grief, Barrett was given a clear vision of a book to try and understand his personal experience of his son's passing. His book, The Silent Gospel, The Science of Divinity, The Creation of the Shroud of Turin, is a result of this period of inquiry. In his book, he marries Eastern and Western science to decipher the embedded testament left in the ancient cloth known as the Shroud of Turin. James currently lives in Northern California and is working on a screenplay about the history of the Shroud. And it's my great pleasure to welcome James Barrett to Authors Audio. How are you doing today, James?
Jake, thanks for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
I'd like you maybe to tell us a little bit about how you got into writing the book, if you would, and then we'll just go on from there.
Sure. Well, I've been interested in human potentiality for many, many years. And along that path, I came to realize that at the center somehow sat the heart. Whether in mystical traditions or viewed from very different perspectives, even medically, your heart, you can be brain dead, but as long as your heart is still beating, you're still alive. So it came that we were looking to try to see if we could develop a tool, a feedback tool, one that could be used, but also show a geometric and mathematical principle that we had. It was a concept. And with the help of many people around the planet, specifically one fellow over at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, we were able to produce a device in the mid-90s. We noticed right away that it was something of value, and it had value in different areas. And we started to develop the product a little more and get it a little more honed so it could be used. It was never done in C++ or anything that you could really use it for usefully in clinical conditions. But we were able to get enough out around the planet for tests and research to demonstrate some of the principles involved with it. So I was interested in coming from that perspective, looking at the heart, heart intelligence, and how it might be looked at so that you could look from a scientific perspective what all the ancient mystical traditions generally spoke about as the heart being the center of a human experience and emotion and actually God intelligence. And then in March of 2000, my son, who was 27 at the time, suddenly and for no apparent reason died on my daughter's birthday in March. And while I was up there cleaning out his apartment and going through the exercises of burial and memorials and things of this nature, I had what could only be called a genuine epiphany. Out of nowhere, a blending of the Shroud of Turin and the heart intelligence material, which I've been researching and looking into now for over 10 years. And somehow, during the epiphany event, it all was crystal clear and made sense. The linking mechanism became the Shroud of Turin and the image on the Shroud. During those epiphany moments that lasted for some time, and afterwards, when I was in sort of a dislocated witnessing perspective, not in my self-pity self of just having lost a son, I had these this whole download, you could say, of seeing this book written clearly. And I was given at that time the table of contents, which you can find on the website, The Silent Gospel. What I found really interesting was at the moment in time when you have this epiphany type events, things look very simple. They look like really clear and easy to accomplish and do, and they all make total perfect sense. Connecting it all up with the shroud was a completely different story because I really didn't have a huge amount of information on the shroud. I knew about it. I knew its history. I knew rudimentary stuff that you hear on the Discovery Channel or something like that. I started to really research it and look into it, and it was my way of also dealing with the grief and the loss, was to, you know, go into this material. And as I did, of course, things grew and developed. And it started to make sense to me, too, because what I found out that I didn't know at the time was that how baffled science was by this. And what I'd been given was a possible methodology, a rational, grounded, rational methodology for how the image came to be imprinted on the shroud. But what it also connected was, which was more important to me at that time and still is connection to the Buddhist rainbow body and incorruptibility and other things like topics like this, which I was really interested in.
There are gaps in the analysis of what the scientists have done, whether it was 1978 or 1988. I think the main central theme that I'll just put out there, and you can tell me if I'm on the ball or not, is that I think you're postulating that this image that we find on the shroud has been caused by some kind of radiated electromagnetic energy or something which burned an image of what looks like a crucified man into the linen in a way that even now we don't understand. Is that correct?
Well, sort of. It's not, no, not exactly. The image wasn't burned into it. It looks, apparently it looks like it's scorching. The actual facts are even much more interesting. The image itself, we could go into on so many different areas. And this is an area I'd love to get into with you, but I think it's probably jumping the fact, but because what there is there's the image itself has no directionality. It's been imprinted after the blood and other forensic evidence was put on the shroud. The shroud, at this point in time, today, the burden of proof is on debunkers. There's two issues of authenticity. One has to do of it actually being an actual burial shroud that covered a corpse. And on that issue, I think we're pretty clear that that's factually the case. The second issue of whether it was the shroud of Jesus, on that, the documentation kind of shows most likely or probable, because without the DNA of an actual body of a person we know of as being Jesus of Nazareth, making conclusive statements about the shroud being the actual shroud of Jesus is hard to do. But if you took the circumstantial evidence and the scientific evidence and you combined them and you took it to a court of law, it would demonstrate, and you were trying to prove it, you would have so many points of correlation that any court would agree if they knew all the evidence, not just what they heard or surmised about it. And if they took away biases, they would certainly agree that the most likely case is that this object, this archaeological object, actually covered a man named Jesus in the first century in Jerusalem, and it was placed on him after a crucifixion that is much more graphically depicted on the shroud itself than in the Bible stories. But it follows the Bible stories in a very unique way. Let me just say this, too. I'd like to just say I don't promote or endorse any religion or any theology or philosophy here. I'm trying to keep my comments grounded. It's hard to do to split them apart when you're talking about an object that's the center of the resurrection and ascension story. That's the foundation for the Christian religion. But I'd like the listeners to understand that I'm not coming from a place of trying to promote Jesus or the Christian story or Buddhism or other things like that. In fact, the opposite is true from what we learned with the heart device.
That's really what I got from your book. You know what I'd like us to do very briefly for our listeners? Maybe we could just do a brief history of the actual Shroud itself and how it came to be. It's obviously, if it is the burial shroud of Jesus, then it's 2,000 years or more old. So maybe you could just give us a brief history of its travels as you know it and how we came to actually have it.
The current modern history that's factual that we know of is that the shroud reemerged in about 1349 to 1350 with a man named Geoffrey de Charnay, who was at that time a renowned popular celebrity type knight who wrote books on chivalry, and he had been in the wars and fighting. He was captured by England and he escaped. And part of the deal, he says in a letter to the Pope, and this is the first record we have of the shroud being in his hands, was that the deal he made was that if he was released from prison, he was going to create a chapel and a place for exhibiting the shroud in public in a town in France. He did escape, he did come back, and he did write this letter to the Pope, and he did build a church, put the shroud in there. That's the current history. From there to the current moment, we know so much about that object. We know where it went, who had it, what years it was shown. I mean, there was maybe 50 different artists that had painted it and had touched it to be sanctified. We know different places it went through fires and wars, and its travels through different royal houses. I mean, it's a very beautiful, complex story. And out of all the things, actually, in the end, what makes it the object the most interesting is that it has survived wars, floods, fires, ancient travel from basically Palestine through Turkey over to Constantinople. It survived wars, intrigue. This part of the story of the shroud, by the way, that's what I'm working on right now, is a screenplay on the history of the shroud with a couple of other people, and we're hoping to get it finished within the next 2 months. This history before 1349 is kind of shrouded a little bit, let's say, not to use it as a pun, but there's a break of about 150 years where we kind of lose somehow the story of it. But from my understanding and from everything I've read and researched on this, which is extensive, the shroud was most likely brought to Edessa by one of the apostles of Jesus, probably an apostle connected with Thomas, Thaddeus Jude. And he brought it to the king of Edessa, who had written letters to Jesus asking him for healing his illnesses, which apparently he viewed as being terminal. Jesus, in the end, sent either Thomas or Thaddeus Jude at some point before 1350, probably between 33 and 40 A.D., this person and the shroud to Edessa. And Edessa, because of the Jewish connection and the Romans, it basically went underground. Let's say 525, it appears to have reemerged, and the story is it was found in, which at that time was called the Edessa Cloth, and it was found in the Western Gate due to a flood or an earthquake. Some might say, like Wilson would claim, maybe it was found after a flood, but it could have been that the town was diminished in its strength to defend itself after the flood, and that maybe through invaders or other stuff or through an earthquake, part of the Western Gate, this is the gate to the city, and inside there they found these treasure trove of relics and items and parchments, and one of them was the shroud itself. The emperor was in Constantinople, and the emperor was the leader of the Christian world at that time from Constantinople, and in 944, he sent an army to basically forcibly remove it from Edessa and bring it back to Constantinople. And when it came back to Constantinople, it remained there till 1204. And 1204 is when this great schism between the Christian religion occurred. The Constantinople was sacked by Venetian and French forces, and it was a split between the Latin and Greek factions of Christianity. And some say it's probably the worst sacking of a city in history other than this, the Roman destruction of Jerusalem in modern times. And during that time, the French took the relics, and the Venetians took the treasure and the gold. And there's a reason for that, too, because this was supposed to be the beginning of the Fourth Crusade, and they were supposed to sail this large armada over to Egypt to begin the retaking of the Holy Lands, which had been lost. This armada, instead, the French troops couldn't pay for it all. So to help pay for it, they said, okay, we'll do what you want, and we'll get the money back for the building of this. Because the amount of ships and the construction of them took the Venetian culture. It was like their center industry and business for several years while they built and developed all this. And so the French nobles decided to support the Venetians, get their some of their money back by helping the Venetians settle a score they had. And that score ended up going all the way to Constantinople, let's say. And that battle was just horrific.
Mm-hmm.
But during that time, there is some evidence that this object, which is the shroud, was taken by French nobles to probably Cyprus and then to Athens, and then from Athens probably through Venice and up to France. And there's where it stayed.
Well, yes, James, if the shroud is 2,000 years old, it has a lot of stories to tell. And I understand that the Templars were involved with it, it seems. And they came into a big struggle with the church and a final dissolution of their order in 1307, I believe. October the 13th was their real bad day that they had, and a lot of them were killed and burnt, I understand. So the Templars play a big role in that also, don't they?
Well, it went on for over 10 years, actually. It started before that, and it actually carried on after that. But in that area, it was definitely a bad day. There was probably 3,000 actual Templar members, and out of that, 600 of them were rounded up and burnt alive. Now, being burnt alive is another story that your listeners should really understand. For a Christian in those years, being burnt alive was like state terrorism. It meant to them that your soul could not return at the end of days because it was burnt. You didn't have a physical body to basically rise again. And so to burn one's body was a way of ensuring that you'll never come back again. It was like a way of ending karma or something, or reincarnation. So it was a very severe punishment. And even at the end, I think what we're talking 1314, when the Grand Master is burnt, and he's burnt with one other fellow, and this fellow's name happens to be Geoffrey de Charnay. Geoffrey de Charnay's nephew is the guy who ends up with the shroud a few years later. Okay, so Geoffrey de Charnay, this is the older uncle, he is burnt alive with the Grand Master of the Templars in Paris, outside of Paris, near a convent, in 1314. And when he dies, that, for all intents and purposes, is the end of the old system of Templars as we know it. And from that moment on, the new organizations of secret societies were born and developed. And instead of having the normal raison d'etre, as they might say, of the old orders, the new purpose for the new order was to diminish the power of the Vatican, especially the temporal powers, especially this office that was recently created called the Office of Inquisition, which is an office that still exists today.
Well, because we don't have time to talk about the complete journey of the Shroud, but it finally ends up in Turin, Italy, correct?
Well, it was turned over from the de Charnay family to the Royal House of Savoy. And the Savoy family, the Royal House of Savoy, basically is the ruling noble family of that northern Italy, eastern France region. And that family has the shroud in its possession from that period of time, 530 years or so, to 1983. And in 1983, the former king and ruler of that family, in his last will and testament, transfers it to the Holy See and the Pope. Yeah, up until that time, the Roman Catholic Church never had possession of it. They had it; they were custodials where it was in their churches, and other members of it oversaw it, but they didn't actually have any ownership to it whatsoever. This is when the story gets really interesting. In 1898, the new interesting novel invention of photography, this fellow, who's a lawyer, takes a picture of the shroud, and for the first time in the negative of the image, he sees the positive image of the man we all know as the Shroud of Turin. That image, after that time, was in 1931 taken again. This Gustav Ernie took another picture at one of the exhibitions that came about during that period of time. So in 1931, they took this photo of the shroud, and copies of that were made and passed around. And what happened was, in 76, we had these individuals that took a copy of the picture, okay, like a photo of the shroud that was from this 1931, and they put it through this device that was created for NASA called a VP8 analyzer. And a VP8 analyzer is basically a device that takes specialized images from outer space, combines them to produce topography of the area they're photographing. And surprise, surprise, this image pops up and shows dimensionality embedded within the image. Now, no painting, no other image, nothing else has ever been able to do that like this object has. And so what happened here is they said, hey, this is nutty. So they get together all their scientist buddies in all these different disciplines, and they said, look at this. How can you do this? And so they all can't figure it out. And they approached the king, and they asked him if they could basically produce this. Then they asked the custodial, the bishop there, if they can do this. And they come up with an agreement to allow them in during this exhibition period into the royal house where the shroud is maintained and kept in Turin. And they are allowed 120 straight hours to do their experiments at that time. And they do them. And so from 78 till 81, they analyze all the results. They go through all the different possibilities. They come up, and in 81, they give the king of Italy the results. The day they were going to give the results to the pope, that was the day that the pope was shot by the fellow that was a Turkish citizen. And so they never got to give him the results on that day. That started a cascade of events. Once that happened, that 1978, 120 straight hours of research and data gathering, and what became clear right from the get-go, as soon as they, in 76, when they put this object through the VP8 analyzer and it had dimensionality into it, was they realized it couldn't be a painting and it couldn't be a photograph. So immediately those were eliminated from the possibilities of what caused this.
Now, is there an image that shows on the back of the shroud?
In 2002, this is sad to even go into, but in 2002, a few people got together and went in to replace the Holland cloth, which is the backing cloth that was put on by the St. Clair nuns after a fire in 1532-34. And that cloth, when it was replaced, they took images of the back of that. But during that process, they used irons on the cloth to stretch it out. They put a new cloth on it. They handled it. It was subject to all kinds of the air of Turin for so long. In essence, they almost completely destroyed any potential for doing further hard science on the object by doing this. There is images taken from the back. That's a whole other side topic that's really challenging to get into.
The interesting part of your book, which I want to really concentrate on and go into, is that you You have married the consequences of scientific investigation with a lot of spiritual ideas and principles. And you start off in chapter 2 talking about, of all things, faith, which I thought was very interesting, because immediately then the reader knows that you're going into all sorts of different levels in looking at how this image was actually made.
If my theory is correct, and if it was going to be correct, I had to look for different models that I could attach it to or find similarities with. So in from a spiritual perspective, the Buddhists have, and other religions have, Taoists and others have the same thing. There's a called a great completion. This completion has several different outcomes, but in essence, this is documented, a person can dissolve their physical form completely. Now, it might range from not the body not corrupting for several days, and only several days, to not corrupting for, you know, years. And I've looked into saints and other stories. I've even gone to Italy. I went to see St. Clair's tomb and look at her body. And from the time I first heard about this was actually through Yogananda and his body not corrupting, and the coroner down in L.A. saying that for 21 days, while he had the body, it smelled great, looked great, and in the end, it had no signs. But see, when I looked into it from a medical perspective, there's the standstill operation, which now I'm sure you can find on the internet and other stuff. But for me, it was a search that I really had to dig deep to find. But they do these medical operations where the definition of being dead, it completely blurs, because they, you know, reduce the body temperature to 58. They take individuals where there's no more electromagnetic signals coming from the brain, or the heart stops. They drain the blood back, so there's no pressure on it. They go into the brain. They do these operations to repair blood vessel damage and things, and then they reconstitute the body. And so it's amazing, because what's really amazing is these people come back with memory. Well, with the where's the memory kept then, you know? How can you witness what's going on in the operation or have memory and knowledge of it in a linear way if it's anchored in the physical and there is no activity in the physical? I mean, there's not even blood circulating. But I looked at it from several different perspectives to try to find ways of marrying the ideas I learned in the heart intelligence work with hard science.
Well, we might say we're in a bit of a mystery spy thriller here. We're on a quest to find out, is this in fact the evidence that we need to prove the resurrection of Jesus? Is this the cloth that produced this image? And is that evidence left behind from the actual resurrection of Jesus? So I'll let you continue on, James. Continue on.
There was a corpse. This we're pretty sure of, that this shroud encompassed and shrouded. And somehow a energy source came from the body direction or area, but at the same time it had to have, see, the actual shroud, the man who was in the enshrouded had on his eyes coins, and there were flowers around the body, and we know the flowers, we can tell a lot of what type they were, where they came from, when they're in blossom, when they're in bloom, and the type of pollens we know rock dust. There's so many pieces of information that the average person doesn't hear about normally on these TV programs that discuss this topic. But when all the evidence is compiled together, you have this picture that you have a person that's physically in the shape of a corpse. Because I don't say dead, because again, like in the standstill or like in yogic powers, you can have dead-like or death-like states, but actually reanimate yourself after. And where your heart stops. I mean, we took this heart device and we did yogis with it. And when some yogis could control their autonomic nervous functions, so they could, you know, have a cut and not bleed, or they could slow their heart down, or they could change different things. And this is visible they're doing it consciously, but you can see it in, like, say, personality disorder functions. And the body can react and change very rapidly under the control of directed mind and intention. That's the bottom line.
Well, interestingly enough, we have many documents about people who have ascended into the clouds like Jesus did. We have, I think, Elijah and apparently Muhammad ascended. And what is the difference really between resurrection and ascension, James?
I think you could, resurrection, I think, would be coming from a physical form that looks dead to being one that looks alive, and coming back from the dead. That's the way I interpret it, yeah. When it comes to ascension, or the resurrection-ascension event, as discussed by Jesus, that is the same as the rainbow body event in my book. That is, and this is something that is well documented. It sounds is very far out, but most scientists and people don't want to go near it because, like incorruptibility of certain physical bodies that don't corrupt, or bodies that don't corrupt right away, even if they last uncorrupted for 6 days and look fine, how that happens bends our normal understanding of physics and the way things normally work. At the core of everything is the way you perceive everything. The way you perceive is literally how you create the reality you exist through. Experiential reality is generated through perception. And there's subtle pieces to that, like intention and the qualitative aspects of them. At the core of that, you have the different facets of mind. And that's something that I think is very important to understand, and it's something that I've directly experienced. And that is that in your normal waking day, when you're operating, you have different facets of your identified self, i.e. mind, operating. One component of that is the part that deals with past and future. And we'll call that, for lack of a better word, time-space. And so time and space aspect, the part that deals with that, is one facet of intelligent, individuated self. And another aspect is timeless or non-local, or let's call it the soul or the atma. And another portion of that intelligence is the heart, and that deals in the now. And so these three, this trinity, let's call it, of components of self, each part of it, by the way, can be bifurcated into other pieces, other component parts. So let's say the egoic past-future component can be bifurcated into many different levels of identity. I'm a radio host, I'm a male, I'm a Canadian, I'm a this, I'm a that. And you can bifurcate it down. Even with the soul, it's the same idea. But it's the soul that's evolving here. And it's the soul, that the timeless aspect, that when perspective shifts and the weight of the use of your awareness shifts to the component that's timeless, then your viewpoint and the way you create reality changes. And this allows for neural pathways to change, genes to be accessed, codons in the amino acid chains to be changed and used differently. So you have different alphabets here to operate with in the construction of stuff. And to take it even further, if you don't view this reality as real anymore and you know reality with a big R, like Maharishi and some of the great gurus have known, then from their perspective, they don't see the reality that you and I might see walking down the street. They see a very different reality. But the core component of that is the emotional side of it, which becomes interconnected compassion. And compassion is the transfiguration of dualism. It's the only emotion that's not anchored in self. By its very definition, it's selfless. But that emotional state, if you can maintain it, like let's say the person Jesus did, by forgiving those who just tortured him like brutally, and oh, by the way, just nailed him with 6-inch spikes to a tree, that level of compassion generates a different level of internal workings physically in the waveform that's made up of your structure.
And I'd just like to remind everyone that we are talking to author James Andrew Barrett about his new book, The Silent Gospel, The Science of Divinity, Creation of the Shroud of Turin. And I'm sure many of you have seen documentaries and so on about this amazing piece of cloth that some people feel is actually the burial shroud of Jesus Christ. And we've been talking about this, and it reminds me how much greater our technology is today, and we can look much, much deeper into what is left in the shroud for us to find out. And the interesting thing is that we find with electron microscopes that we're basically everything is a form of energy. Everything has atoms and electrons moving around it and so on. And we are a form of very special energy also. So perhaps that energy somehow in the resurrection of Jesus actually made this impression on the cloth. And we can talk more about that now.
Everything that's a thing is vibrating. Not everything in the truest sense of the term. Yeah, everything that's a thing, that's objectifiable, is moving, yes. Well, it's just important because at this point in our culture and our history, we need to redefine so much of the way we perceive life. I mean, the Newtonian physics is dropping by the side, and we have now quantum physics taking over. But even in quantum physics, they haven't entered yet fully the place of consciousness to operate within it. I mean, the only place it's always been is they use the term the observer. And the observer, of course, is this other aspect of self that's non-localized, the part that might be able to travel or dream or remote view, this other part that's interconnected into the web of existence in a more intimate way than the one that's standing, you know, in this room right now feeling as a separate identity. You know, I never touched on it really fully for you when you brought up the second chapter, the one on faith. You see, most people think of faith and they think of some sort of dogma, some sort of religion. They think of something like that. Faith is not belief. It's not hope. Those come out of the rational mind. True faith, if you wanted a Western term, would be open, receptive, allowing. It's allowing to be with what is. It's having that inner strength to be confident in what it is. I mean, literally, to be not to be wanting, desiring, wishing. It's to be okay with the present moment, the way it's constructed, because in the end, you've constructed it that way. You've done it. And it somehow is your path back into remembrance, which is... that's all it really ever is. I mean, awakening, illumination, all those words that seem like you have to do yoga and many interesting prayers and meditations for, those are all processes to help the psychology of the individual to remember that which has always been. It's nothing more than that. And once you remember your true nature, your soul, that's the you know, that's the actual guy behind the carriage and the horses here, pulling the reins, that's the part that's evolving. And remembrance of that aspect of self allows one to be in at the base camp for inner exploration. That's all it does. It's not the end of it, the ride. It's not like the goal of the ride. It just allows one to get to a base camp for the level of exploration that only the great inner explorers have ever done. The ones that have started most of the great religions of the planet and many others that we've never heard about. But these are the souls that have brought us the great practices. I mean, the Hindu and practices from the old forests of the Indian subcontinent, these go back thousands of years before Christ. Buddha lived 500 years in something before Jesus did. And it's interesting to me, the cross-pollination that happened during those years was extensive. I mean, the Romans were buying, and the Greeks were before that, but let's just go to the Roman times. They were buying and trading goods with the Indian subcontinent, and oh, by the way, the Silk Road and the King's Highway existed, and there were ships coming back and forth constantly from the Indian subcontinent up into Egypt, into the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean was a great market for all their spices. I mean, the ivory, the tusks, the spices that were traded, and the silks and the cloth came from India. And the great gift of the Romans, similar to the American culture or the North American culture, was that they didn't inhibit personal religious growth in any way. They allowed, the Romans knew that the idea for security was to have good commerce. If everybody was making money and could eat and feel good, there was no problems with, insurrection. People didn't insurrect against the government as long as things were going good. So they allowed it to be as open and as flowing as possible. And if you stepped out of bounds, of course, the repercussions were pretty swift, and you were nailed to a cross, let's say, in the Palestine area. And so that the idea that Buddhist and Hindu and beliefs were present, I mean, there were Zoroastrians, and then just the Egyptian beliefs, and there was different levels of Jewish belief. The Jewish belief we normally hear about, the ones that were in control, let's say, of Jerusalem at that time, were a certain wing of Jerusalem. There were other wings of Jerusalem, like there are other wings of Christianity or other wings of Buddhism or any other religion that existed. And in Alexandria, at the same time as Jesus was walking and talking, there were these ashrams that Philo writes about, where people would get rid of their wealth and go there to directly experience communion with the divine. I mean, and it would be men and women equal. I mean, that's pretty novel, right? I mean, you don't hear or read about that too often, but it existed at the same time and place. And I think that the notions of the Indian subcontinent and other truth is truth, regardless of who brings it forth.
Well, the interesting thing is, too, is that the teachings of Jesus, whether a person is a Christian or not, the teachings of Jesus are so beautiful in terms of getting back into this heart resonance that you're talking about. It's really, the teachings are really instructing, directed at the heart, aren't they?
And Jesus, I think in Matthew, and I'm not good with the Bible and quoting them precisely, but when he was asked about his commandment, what should they do, he said, love your God with all and your neighbor with all your heart, your soul, and your mind. He said all three things, your heart, your soul, and your mind. He actually laid out the Trinity. He actually said it completely, and it's fully right there. And if everybody would follow that commandment, when they said, well, is that it? And he said, yeah, that's it. That's the commandment that everything rests on. And then in other texts, he mentions, don't tell lies. Don't be dishonest to yourself. Because in essence, for you to produce the loving state that I'm talking about, if I had you on a device and I was measuring it, the best way for you to produce it is when you're being genuine to yourself. That shows up on the devices as a loving act, deeply loving act. So by being you in the now, not being hooked into it that, oh, I got to be like this tomorrow, but by being genuine in the moment, you produce these wonderful loving signatures in your waveform. And that waveform, by the way, for your listeners, looks like an apple. It's called a torus. But it's like an apple shape, and it goes out around from your body. And you carry this large body of light, electromagnetic energy, but it's a body of light. And it's out at least 10 to 12 feet from your body measurably. And you walk around with this waveform of energy and light constantly modulating according to what's coming in from external sources, but more importantly, how you're perceiving and thinking and feeling towards what you're experiencing. And that's why it's so radically important to shift the way you perceive things and look at things. And when you do, like you go down to the beach and you see in a sunset and your mind stops and you just have this big, you know, beautiful experience of watching the sun goes down and the mind's quiet and you just have an awe feeling, an agape. And that sense is really wonderful for generating wellness in the body, perfect immune functions, autoimmune balance. I mean, so many wonderful things medically. And the rationale is very simple. When you have those states, the amount of dissonance affecting the field is minimized greatly. So you have much less activity needing to go towards other things. So you end up with a sort of calm, peaceful response in the physical body. And most of that impulse, by the way, comes through many seconds prior to actually cognitive awareness of the facts or even the act of something happening. Many studies have shown that 3 to 12 seconds, so many heartbeats prior to an actual event being randomly triggered by a computer, whether it be sound or visual stimulus, your body is armoring and preparing for, even though the computer in time space hasn't even chosen the moment yet for it to happen. I find that totally just beautiful. I mean, I'm just here, you know, walking along talking with you, but I've already, in time space, dealt with it all before the actual event, or I'm dealing with it all, or I'm aware of it all. When Gretzky used to go score up in Edmonton, he used to say, everything slows down. I can see everything in slow motion. Everything feels like time has almost stopped, and I make my decisions from there. And that's actually very, very accurate. It's a very accurate statement of the reality that we all can attain simply by just bringing more awareness to the heart. I mean, the heart literally has, first off, Jake, the heart has no external sources in order to operate. It's not operated by the brain or something else. Yeah. Well, the facts on the heart that I have in the book are just some of them, but they are amazing in and of themselves, just by themselves. The heart has at the center of this big waveform, this apple-shaped torus waveform, at the center where the two vortices meet at the heart near the sinoatrial node, there's a what's called a phase singularity. By the way, that's at the center of every atom and every subatomic particle, too. They're all the same design in terms of their shape, their overall shape. And that phase singularity at the center, to give your listeners just something else to find that I find totally amazing, think of your heart pumping this frequencies out like a symphony. You go to the symphony, and you have the symphony of sound, and it's broadcast out away from you. And then the same energy form sucks it back in to its source. It goes back to the beginning, just like DNA does. It goes back to where it originated. And when it goes back there, it goes back into a phased one singularity space. It's like being at the South Pole, and you're standing right at the South Pole, and you look straight up. Now, you have all these longitude lines coming down at you. But right where you're stepping, you don't have any longitude lines. There's nothing. It becomes amorphous. And the same thing is with energy in the body and in the heart and with all structure that we know of. And that structure is very malleable. You can modulate it. I mean, I can control your mind, the way you feel. And that's what happens. That's what music does. That's what it does.
Well, James, as I've been listening to you, I'm reminded of that great teacher of mythology, Joseph Campbell, who put out some wonderful tapes with Bill Moyers called The Power of Myth. But his basic tenet was that life was grounded on bliss and joy and the great potential of your life or anyone's life was to follow that bliss that you feel and open up and use it. And even in the Bible, we're talked about we are the children of God. We're made in the image of God. And if that's the case, then there's so much joy to be had in life if we are following, like you say, following the heart path, then anything is possible.
Exactly. And it's not even me saying it. I'm referencing all the great wisdom seekers, inner explorers, throughout history. This is not a cultural phenomena. It's not a racial phenomena. We are created in an ability to truly recognize the reality of that which we are, not the reality that we're made of or from or with. It's much more comprehensive than that, and that's the truly amazing thing. And literally, the most amazing part is it's just a simple shift in the way you perceive things, and the where that perception is coming from, the angle of it, that makes all the difference. That's all it is. I mean, people try to make it much more complicated than it actually is. I mean, everybody wants a new practice to become identified with. I'm a great yoga, you know, I'm a vegetarian, I do this, I do that. And Jesus himself said, go out and be real, tell the truth, eat what they serve you. It wouldn't have even been so bad, but he knew what was coming down. I mean, he chose to go in at a time where he knew that the slightest disruption meant pretty severe punishment. He knew this, and you don't go in at that time and place and do this like that. He had a lineage and a family history that is connected with, some priestly lines of, the Jewish lineage. And he also understood that he'd kind of done everything he could do now, and it was time to really leave the final. Imagine this. I believe that Jesus was married and had a wife and children. That's my personal belief based on my reading. But whether he did or didn't, one of his apostles, this woman and his mother and another lady or so, come to see him to actually prepare the body. And they're coming to the tomb and they see the stone rolled back. This is the story we have, okay? You can take it apart many different ways. But in essence, they come in because they didn't have time before, from their culture and their religion, to prepare the body properly for formal burial. They just put it in the tomb to protect it. And they were going in to actually prepare it, clean it, fix it up for proper burial for eternity. And they get there, and what they find, regardless of all the other parts of the stories, is they find this cloth that must have been absolutely brilliant when it was new in its negative form. Now, so it's not even an image of the body in the true form. It's an image in negative. And it must have just been, I mean, as much as it blows my mind today, you can imagine 2,000 years ago in Palestine, this, fairly rustic place going into this hand-hewn tomb and then finding this object. And the perspective on it is beyond, it's obvious that this laid over the man that had been recently enshrouded in it. And they carry this out, and that is what, just prior to this, all these apostles are running and hiding and denying knowing Jesus, and now all of a sudden they have all this faith. Well, what caused that? Where did that faith come from all of a sudden? It came from this object that was truly amazing. People were said to heal people all the time. That was a normal practice for any healer of the day. To do magical, mystical type of things. But to have this object that was way beyond anything that they'd ever seen or heard of before must have been truly amazing for them when they first gathered and looked at it. And I believe that that's what gave them the faith to go out there and actually begin this new religion and to actually teach it the way that he originally taught it. Unfortunately, over 2,000 years and with power being the way it is and the way and money being and wealth being the what it is, things get tweaked along the road.
Well, it is getting to that point where we have to say goodbye, but before we do, I'd like to warmly thank James Andrew Barrett for appearing with us on Authors Audio to talk about his brand new book called The Silent Gospel, The Science of Divinity and the Creation of the Shroud of Turin. I highly recommend the book. It's very well detailed, and James has developed many of his own ideas about the shroud in the book himself. You can get it at our website at www.authorsaudio.com and click on the photo image of his book, and you'll be directed to Amazon.com. Also, you can visit James Barrett's website. It's called thesilentgospel.com, just thesilentgospel.com. And he has many more insights and shares his ideas on the book there also. So with that, I say keep dreaming and happy reading. This is Jake D. Steele. Bye for now.